ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A young scientist flees Nazi Germany and ends up building the atomic bomb for Britain and America. But behind the lab coat, he's a Soviet spy. Klaus Fuchs, the physicist who decided the fate of the world and gave the West's greatest secrets to the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app or look for it on the ABC Rewind podcast feed.
An awful lot of people choose to believe that the date of their birth influences the type of person they are and even how their life will develop over future years. For instance, if you're born between the 19th of February and the 20th of March, you and everybody else born between those dates share common traits. You're said to be passionate, creative, and imaginative. And there's even a label for you. Your label is Pisces. I'm talking, of course, about astrology. And as I say, many people still believe the idea, but there is actually no scientific evidence behind it all. Believing in astrology is like believing in a card trick, in magic. Now, for the sake of a thought experiment, let's use another type of label, this time a generational label, and go wider. Let's decide that everyone born between, say, the dates 1965 and 1980, well, let's decide that they all think and act in the same way, largely in the same way, give or take a few differences. Let's then ascribe them some common traits. We could describe them as resourceful and independent. Also, open-minded, which you might think is a good thing, but they do tend towards cynicism, which is perhaps not so good. And finally, let's give them a label. Let's call them Generation X, or Gen X for short. I'm sure you get my point. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense and a program about the seductive nature of generational labelling, about the way in which terms like Gen X and Baby Boomer and Millennial are constantly employed within our society, despite the fact that the science behind them is thin to say the least. So where did they come from? Why are they so popular? And what influence can they have on our future direction?
Well, they have quite a mixed history and origin. Different labels come from different sources, mostly.
Bobby Duffy, a professor at King's College London and the author of The Generation Myth.
So the baby boomers, that is based on a demographic reality for lots of countries. There was a baby boom post-war, and it's usually US Census Office that's credited with coming up with that as an initial term. But then you move on to more cultural generations. So the next generation in chronologically was Generation X, which isn't really based on a demographic or economic reality, not a firm one at least. It's much more cultural. It comes from the Douglas Copeland book called Gen X. Then you move on to millennials, which is sort of in reference to a point in time that people that were coming of age around the millennium. And that's credited to Strauss and Howe, a couple of commentators on generational thinking who coined that term. And then Gen Z is just because the original name for millennials was Gen Y, because that followed Gen X. So, and again, we're still arguing about where Gen Z actually begins and ends, particularly where it ends, because people have already moved on to a new label for the next generation, which rather unimaginatively is Generation Alpha. So we've gone round the alphabet and are just starting with alphas and betas. So it's a real mixed bag of generational labels and sources and generational length. So none of the generations that we commonly refer to are actually the same number of years for each of the cohorts. So it's quite a messy, varied environment for it.
And yet they're talked about and they're used, aren't they, as if they are coherent and consistent?
They are. I mean, it's really come into the public consciousness in the last 10, 15 years, not unrelated to the rise of social media and, you know, snappier labels that are easier to share in limited characters on social media and then bleeding into the media. So yes, they have got much more prominent now, but in usually shorthands for very stereotypical views and images that people have in mind. So it's very useful for headline writers to have very short labels, Gen Z, millennials, etc., that prompt an image among people of who you are talking about. But actually, that label and image covers a vast number of people that are very varied in reality.
I mean, it gives managers, it gives organizations kind of convenient way to classify people, to group them. Been going on for a very, very long time. I think people talked about the boomers and then the millennials and now the Gen Z, Zeds, and there's a debate about what the next one's going to be called, although I don't think it should be called anything. So I think it's just a convenience. We'd like to group people. It makes our lives easier. And from a management perspective, it's a heck of a lot easier to say all these people of this age range are the same, and so I can treat them the same, versus some of them are like it, some of them aren't, and how do I figure that out? So I think it's more of a kind of a heuristic convenience than anything else. My name is David Costanza. I'm a professor of commerce at the McIntyre School at the University of Virginia.
So there's a contradiction at the heart of generational labeling. They're meant to be about more accurately defining people, but in their usage, they actually end up simply suppressing individuality. And here's another thing about generational labels. When you think about it, they're very American, very US-centric.
12 years ago, I was at a conference and I went to a session on generations because I was just starting to look into it. At a conference in this session, we broke into tables to discuss pros and cons and issues. And I happened to be at a table with someone from South Korea and somebody from Germany and a couple people from the United States. And I was just starting to get the sense of, oh, these events affect people. So I asked my colleagues from overseas, I said, you know, so in the United States, we use these events and these dates. Which ones do you use? What are the key, you know, historical events, political events, cultural events that affected the people in your country? And both of them just looked at me kind of puzzled and said, well, we just use the ones from the United States. And it didn't make any sense that someone from South Korea would talk about, you know, historical events in the U.S. as creating generations there. So I think because a lot of the academics and the consultants who started it are from the United States, that's the ones that were used. But, you know, it's absurd to think that something that happened in the U.S. in 1990 would define a generation in Israel or Nigeria or any place else other than here.
And in one way, when you look at those generational stereotypes, if you want to call them that, they're very static, the characteristics that are assumed, say, particularly of Gen Z. There's no assumption that group of people born at a certain time will, in fact, over time change their beliefs or their behaviors.
No, you're exactly right. It's again, that's what happens when you kind of group people. I would definitely use the word stereotypes when you group them into these heuristic groups. It's happened through history. You know, we've said over time, people from a particular gender, they're all this way, or people from a particular race, they're all this way, or people from a particular age, they're all this way. And they're not. I mean, people are dynamic. They change. They grow over time. I think one of the things that's confusing to a lot of business folks and a lot of lay people is that people do change systematically over time. You know, for instance, as they get older, they get more risk averse. So young people are more willing to take risks than older people. And that translates into the new workers are risk takers, or they're not committed to their jobs, or they're more willing to move. And so if you look back 30, 40 years, the same people would be saying the same thing about the new workers at that point in time. So they are static in the sense of once they're assigned to the group, they tend to get labeled, you know, the boomers are this way and the Xers are this way, but people aren't static. They do change over time in fairly standard, predictable ways. And that's really a much more interesting question. Like, what drives that? What makes you less risk averse as you get older, as opposed to saying young people take risks?
How much of this is driven by marketing? Because you can imagine that for advertisers, say, for marketing people, it's very convenient to be able to group people into these little cohorts.
Yeah, I think that it's a great point. In fact, I just did an interview with a marketing magazine in England about this exact issue. And what I would say is I would separate the labeling of people as a target market with the generational theory. So if you want to say people born between 1946 and 1964 are at a particular stage in their life, and therefore they need these type of products. Sure, I mean, they do. People who are in that age group need different products than people who are born in 2000. But once you use the label, once you say baby boomers need these products, then all the baggage that goes with that gets laid on top of it.
Some of the real bedrock work of any science is categorization. If you look at Darwin, if you look at astronomy, I mean, what are these things we're looking at and can we put them in categories? That's, the building block of all science. And we do the same thing in social science. We talk about race and gender and age. And these things are all, meaningfully identifying categories and then trying to measure them and wrestling over that. That's what we do.
Philip Cohen, a professor of sociology and a demographer from the University of Maryland.
If you say kids these days are, really having a hard time socializing since the pandemic, that's a reasonable thing to say. But if you name that group, call them Generation B, and then you expect them to still be behaving that way in 10 years, it doesn't really make sense. But it takes a while for that realization to hit you. Meanwhile, you've already named the group, and it seems to make sense because kids are different from adults at any point in time. And so, there's a certain appealing logic to it, and you get sort of what we call a face validity to your term. You're saying, there's obviously a difference between young people and old people. I don't know how to even work my iPhone, and these kids are total digital natives. And then, you put a name to that. It's natural, but it's a lesson we have to keep learning that if you're really thinking in generation terms, you have to expect those things you're applying to them to carry with them as they go. And, millennials are all grown up now. But if you look at the way we talked about millennials 20 years ago, they were kids. And we were just saying the stuff that we say about kids.
So it's frustrating for researchers like yourself. Does it, though, actually impede social science research?
I do think it's harmful in a couple of ways. One is stereotyping. And stereotyping, it's a way of putting on blinders and presuming the answer before you start. And so it can mess up your research, but more than that, it can mess up the way, regular people read, interpret, and think about the kinds of things that we're trying to understand and communicate about. So if you're expecting a certain result or a certain attitude or certain behavior based on stereotypes, that's, just going to mislead you. It may mislead you in certain, not random ways. These are very diverse groups, but we tend to kind of think of the dominant group. So, the stereotypes about millennials basically mostly described middle class and upper middle class white people. And we had to there were multiple rounds of people saying, not all millennials are white. I was like, but their character, they seem so privileged and spoiled. Anyway, so we kept going through that. So that was one way. The other is if you are interested in the way that culture changes through history, it really is important to think about breaks like this that may matter. It may really matter that some kids grew up using social media from the age of middle school or something, and that may set them apart in a way that matters for the rest of their lives. And we should be attuned to that, and we should be looking for those things, but you can't fix those categories before you start the research. And so there is a risk that if you're, if you look at millennials are, a great example, they're cut in half by what we used to call the Great Recession, the financial crisis of 2009 or so. And the so-called millennials from before and after that period, in terms of when they were entering adulthood, had very different life experience. And I look at birth rates and marriage rates and, early versus late millennials have a whole different pattern of family life. And if you started out with the assumption that this was a meaningful category in your research, you would totally miss that. So it's a caution for researchers, and it's a potential problem for just the public in discussing and trying to understand important things about social change.
So generational labeling in the eyes of sociologists and demographers like Philip Cohen, even if well-intentioned, quickly descends into little more than pop culture pseudoscience. Now, Professor Cohen is an important figure in the story of generational labelling because he was instrumental in organising a professional pushback. A pushback directed at the otherwise well-regarded, very professional, non-partisan US-based research organisation, the Pew Research Centre. Here's what happened.
Actual social scientists, outside of a very small sort of niche, do not use these categories. We either just sort of group people by decades or we group people according to something that actually happened. If you're interested in people who graduated high school during the pandemic, that's a particular experience at a moment in time at a certain age that may shape them for the rest of their lives. But the discourse was progressing without us, had left us behind in a lot of ways, especially in journalism, where these things are for some reason extremely attractive clickbait. People love to click on things that are about generations. And the Pew Research Center had developed a habit. They're in the business of communicating and they want people to read their good research. And they had developed a habit of grouping people according to these generations. And then, because they are good social scientists, they went through the trouble of sort of assigning the specific age range to them. And they sort of came to be seen as the official arbiters of the generation labels and categories and when to draw the line between millennial and Gen X or whatever. But no one had ever really done the research to see if these categories made sense, to compare them to some other scheme and see if that fits the data better, all the things that we normally do in science before we use categories. And those of us who were in demography especially were really frustrated by this. And I realized that I could get a lot of prominent social scientists and demographers together pretty easily to just sign a simple statement urging Pew to please just stop doing this.
In fact, Philip Cohen managed to get more than 170 signatories. And after some soul searching, Pew released an open letter of its own, entitled How Pew Research Center Will Report on Generations Moving Forward. Here's some of what it had to say.
We decided to take a step back and consider how we can study generations in a way that aligns with our values of accuracy, rigor, and providing a foundation of facts that enriches the public dialogue. Generational research has become a crowded arena. The field has been flooded with content that's often sold as research, but is more like clickbait or marketing mythology. By choosing not to use standard generational labels when they're not appropriate, we can avoid reinforcing harmful stereotypes or oversimplifying people's complex lived experiences.
And if you go to the Future Tense website, you'll find we've linked to both Philip Cohen's open letter and the full response from Pew, which covers several pages. Now, Pew Research gives several useful tips for how best to conduct generational research in future. And they include, only do generational analysis when there's historical data available that will allow you to compare generations at similar stages of life. And when making generational comparisons, always attempt to control for other factors beyond age. So, let's recap. The generational labels that are so prominent today, love them or loathe them, aren't based on science, even though they're regularly used by people who should know better. They're popular because they provide politicians, the media, and of course influencers with the useful shorthand that they believe the public can easily understand and identify with. But I can't help wondering if another part of their appeal is that generational labels fit nicely into the discourse of identity, our modern tendency to label everything and everyone, including ourselves. Crystal Aberdeen is a digital anthropologist at Curtin University in Western Australia.
I study generational politics with regards to how social media pop cultures and online vernacular are used to express self-identity. And I've done a cluster of studies focusing on TikTok specifically. For this platform, we need to remember a brief history, which is that when TikTok first launched globally, it was primarily used by Gen Z, very young users. If we look at Big P politics, a lot of the Gen Z folks who are coalescing online are doing so in place of the ability to actually effect change in society due to lack of resources, being in the right spaces, or being ineligible to vote. And so at this point, a lot of the discursive activism that they take part in is with small p personal politics or social politics, where they're learning about society, learning about their viewpoints, learning about their own principles, values, and ethos. So social media, digital culture, and platforms in general have long been this safe haven and space where minority groups go and find each other. It's about not feeling that you're in isolation and connecting to other people. And by default of connecting to other people, you form community, you find ways to self-identify as a group, and perhaps doing so as a generational cohort is one of those ways.
Another interesting thing that Professor Aberdeen's research suggests is that the standard generational labels currently in use in our world are being further refined as identity markers by certain social media communities.
Within the space of TikTok and other platforms, we need to remember that time and content moves really quickly. And so there are these micro graduations for how you can identify as an early Gen Z, a mid Gen Z, a late Gen Z. There are even conversations across the cohorts, like young or old millennials referring to other cohorts and their younger and older groupings. And this is quite a nice way of recognizing that while centrally with everyday lived experiences, these generations share the same systemic and institutional issues. On a space like social media, their everyday experiences online, as mediated through the pop culture references they have, their immediate concerns, are broken down into smaller year batches and year groups. This is, of course, important because the experience of a middle schooler would be so different from a high schooler. Someone who's experiencing the challenges as a young millennial just entering the job market would be different from an older millennial who's maybe raising tweens or teenagers. And so acknowledging that is also space to include diversity and inclusivity in the conversation.
If we're talking about generational politics, though, does that risk falling then into balkanization, that you just end up with so many subcategories?
It's useful to some extent, because given that social media is so fragmented, it is difficult to identify just one entire generation as a community. All of those experiences differ by simple demographics like your gender, sexuality, education, class, even your cultural background or where you grew up in the world. And so it helps for these micro communities to form within the generation so they can focus on the intersectional politics that means the most to them. But when it comes to calling out something that is a large scale issue, something like the OK Boomer hashtag or trend that was really popular on TikTok from 2019 till today, allows these young people to come together, rally together like a generational anthem. It tells them you have to put aside these micro differences and now we're collectively working on the same major issue. It's time to collaborate and cooperate, and we can split into our micro fragments later or when it's more productive.
But while employing labels as a reinforcement and declaration of identity might actually be beneficial to certain individuals and minority groupings, what do they do for our wider social cohesion? Bobby Duffy again.
This type of labelling encourages this sense of conflict between generations, that you are in one generation or the other, and one is set up against the other. So while millennials are accused of killing traditions that people hold dear, it's boomers who are blamed for ruining things, ruining everything, whether that's the economy or climate or aspects of culture. So yes, absolutely. When you identify very simplistically one group and say it is different from another group, that naturally encourages that sense of conflict. That is a damaging thing within generational thinking. So just taking climate as an example, people often set up climate change concern as something that only the younger generation have, and it's actually baby boomers and Gen X who don't care about this. But when you look at the actual data, there's very little difference in climate concern between those generations. And actually, baby boomers and Gen X are more likely to act in boycotting products or services for social purpose reasons than younger generations. So we're setting up this division between old and young that's just not true. But it's also very damaging because we need people to come together on climate change rather than saying it's one side against another. There is a human innate characteristic to think of yourself as in one group and to set up an identity based on that group that is in contrast to other groups. So being part of a tribe in some sort of way. But I do think our modern social media and political environment accentuates that.
So in that sense, then, the fascination with generational labels, the interest in generational labels really fits with the times, doesn't it?
It does. And again, slightly the tragedy for me in this is that kind of tribal identity driven version of generational thinking distracts us, so particularly building in this sense of conflict between generations, distracts us from the really big, true generational differences, which are that it is tougher for younger generations economically. Those types of really big cohort effects are true. but they're not the focus. Because we get pulled into these more frothy debates about cultural differences.
The stereotypes are very familiar. So you might say, oh, well, this is my tribe, this is my group of people, but I'm not like that, right? It's kind of funny if you say, are you a millennial, to someone, and they'll think about how old they are and they go, oh yeah, I am. And then you say, okay, well, millennials are stereotyped as not committed, lazy, unwilling to work hard, just, you know, want to go out and have fun, do all those things. And they'll go, oh, well, that's not me. And I said, well, I mean, that's what you just said you were, at least according to the stereotype. So again, I think, you know, from a grouping standpoint, if it gives someone a sense of belonging, if it tells them who their cohort is, people who are going through the same things in the world that they are, sure. But there's a disconnect there. I was talking to a book rep at a conference a couple years ago after some of my stuff came out, and she said, oh, well, you know, I wanted to talk to you about potentially writing a book about the alternate explanations and, you know, what's wrong with generations. And I kind of laughed and said, well, I mean, I can do that, but quite honestly, the book would be very short. It would be, there's no empirical evidence for generations. Stop talking about them. Stop using the labels. Look at how old someone is and where they are in their life. And that's your best predictor of what's going to happen. End of book, right? It's a one-page book. And that doesn't sell. You know, a one-page book that just says stop is not very sexy.
I am pessimistic that this will go away, partly because there's a little bit of a ratchet effect where once something is popular, the incentive to create and name the next generation and be the one who gets ahead of that, have your name catch on, have your term become the popular term. There are enough people in the business of especially business research, business consulting, people who are selling their ideas as unique and cutting edge and the thing you need to know now. That industry is where a lot of this is generated now. We're not going to be able to have the collective discipline to avoid naming the next one. Somebody is already naming the generation after next and focus grouping it and trying to come up with a term that's going to stick. And I don't see an end to it, because the reward for not using generation labels is a nice feeling of satisfaction that you're doing the right thing. The award for making up a new generation label that sticks is, you know, wealth and fame. So I don't see an end anytime soon.
Philip Cohen from the University of Maryland. We also heard today from David Costanza at the University of Virginia, King's College London's Bobby Duffy, and Crystal Abedin from Curtin University. The producer for this particular edition of Future Tense was Natalie Tenchik. This was the final in our five-part series of highlight programs played over the Australian summer, and indeed the final Future Tense program ever. After 17 years, the show is coming to an end. But as I mentioned a few weeks back, I'm not exactly departing the field. I'm moving over to co-present the program Rear Vision, also on ABC Radio National, of course. So make sure you join me there. My first program will be on trade sanctions and trade warfare. It feels like we're entering a new era of global economic coercion, but analysts suggest that we're actually returning to the past, going back to the same kind of trade weaponization that existed up until the Second World War. So I'll catch you next week on a different program, a different podcast, and at a different time. Thanks as always to my co-creator and co-producer here at Future Tense, Karin Zsivanovits. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.